At the beginning of the Terry lecture series, we had Professor Peter Harrison, Director of the Centre for the History of European Discourses at the University of Queensland, and the ABC's online religion and ethics editor, Scott Stevens, setting up the topic. And you can listen back to this interview on our website. Now, here they are again, summing up the complex question of the relationship between science and religion.
Now, Peter Harrison, most often, and unfortunately, I would say we heard this at the conclusion of Keith Thompson's final lecture, the relationship between science and religion today seems almost to be hijacked by two, I would regard as rather extreme responses to how one thinks about the relationship between science and religion. We always hear examples, as we did from Keith Thompson, about congressmen who regard Darwinian evolution or evolution by natural selection as, you know, a perfidious lie straight from the pit of hell. At the same time, we have what some might regard as being ultra-naturalists or ultra-Darwinians like Daniel Dennett and others regarding evolution by natural selection as a kind of intellectual and almost metaphysical acid. It eats away millennia of religious and theological, but also philosophical and moral reflection. But surely those two extreme examples, that doesn't encapsulate the sum of the way in which science and religion might understand themselves.
Yes, I think that's exactly true. And the first thing perhaps to remember on this score is that conflict sells well. So people like to pick up on conflicts and extreme examples, very often ignoring what middle ground there might be. Now, when we talk about middle ground, it's probably worth also saying that there isn't a lot of overlap between science and religion, that there are many aspects of science that don't really have significant implications for religious views, and many religious claims that don't have scientific implications or implications that can be contradicted by science. So there is overlap, but not significant overlap, in my view. The naturalist Stephen Jay Gould used to talk about non-overlapping magisteria in this context, which is to say that science and religion, for the most part, are relatively independent.
And do you think that idea of non-overlapping magisteria is still a productive and a helpful concept?
I think it's useful because it points us to the fact that the overlap is not significant, although I think there is overlap, and it's very often at those areas of overlap that we get these highly charged debates. But it's worth saying now, when we think about these highly charged debates, we tend to construct them as science versus religion, but often they're proxies for something else. And I think if we look at, say, fundamentalist religious reactions against evolution in America, and this is the prime locus for these, we sometimes forget that these conflicts are proxies for more deep-seated ideological battles. And what fundamentalist critics of evolution are against is what they see as a package of secularist values being packaged up as scientific theory. And when people like Richard Dawkins make claims that evolution naturally points us towards atheism, they're confirmed in their view that evolution is more than just a scientific theory, but that in fact it's a disguised ideology. And I think on the other side, the ultra-Darwinists, and let's remember that this is really a small part of a spectrum within the scale of evolutionary thinking, that these individuals often use Darwinian theory as a medium for a set of secularist values that they hold dear. And there's nothing wrong necessarily with holding those values or indeed with propagating them, but it's the association of those ideas with a particular scientific theory that its critics find problematic. So I think that's part of the analysis of that one area of conflict that occurs over evolution.
And it's been particularly interesting to me, say over the last 5 and 6 years in particular, that much of the pushback against these highly recognizable, best-selling ultra-Darwinians, a great deal of the pushback hasn't just happened from, let me just put it as people with a dog in this particular fight, in other words, people from a religious or theological persuasion, but even thinking of someone like Thomas Nagel, his recent book Mind and Cosmos, and the ongoing work of people like Jerry Fodor, who are saying that even this particular construal of Darwin and the way in which a particular understanding of Darwinism has been allowed to colonize the entire metaphysical, philosophical, and moral field, that there's something about that that leaves a great deal to be desired.
That's exactly right. So I think, first of all, from the scientific perspective, the ultra-Darwinists represent a particular gene-centered approach that was fairly popular in the 60s and 70s, but now has long been overtaken, I think, by perhaps not alternative accounts, but accounts that offer a somewhat different version of evolution. And these focus, say, on group selection, evolutionary developmental biology, or evo-devo, as it's called. Also, I think, gives a challenge to some of these more ultra-Darwinist approaches. But beyond that, I mean, if we move out of the sciences, there are philosophical critiques of extreme Darwinism. And Thomas Nagel, whom you mentioned, is just the latest example of an interesting development of philosophical critique against an extreme version of Darwinism. And Nagel's view is that naturalistic Darwinism, if it posits a world without goals, then it's really incapable of giving an account of some things that we regard as very important, like moral values and human consciousness.
So let me put to you, given the fact that our conversation is taking place after four Terry lectures that have been trying to, I suppose, pick apart something of the past relationship between science and religion, from your perspective, and not simply being constrained by the Terry lectures or the relationship between Jefferson and Darwin in particular, what do you think the complex past that science and religion share? What does that say about how we can begin thinking about science and religion in our present and indeed into the future?
Well, I think the first thing we can say, and this was apparent in the lectures themselves, is that we should stop talking about disembodied isms like science and religion, and think rather in terms of the complexity of historical events and their contingency. And in the lectures we saw that nicely with a focus on the biographies of key individuals. And it's when we look at how individuals wrestle with these various problems that we get some sense of the fact that there's no really simple answer, and it's not just a case of there being these monolithic entities, science and religion, that are somehow locked in this perennial battle. So I think that's the first lesson. I guess the other thing is that when we study the history of science, we see that it's a history of successive theories, and that although some of these theories have implications that at times do seem to run contrary to traditional religious beliefs, bear in mind that scientific theories change over time, and that if you sit and wait for long enough, then perhaps things will change. And as we were just saying, it's very interesting to see it looks as if, to some degree, there's a reaction against at least more extreme versions of evolutionary theory. And my suggestion, I hasten to add, is not that evolutionary theory is wrong, but that rather science is by nature a provisional activity, and that we don't have to put our faith in the particular current manifestation of a scientific theory.
Professor Peter Harrison, the director of the Centre for the History of European Discourses at the University of Queensland and ABC's online religion and ethics editor, Scott Stevens, with their take on the Terry Lectures and the relationship between science and religion.